And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting throughout Hamilton on your FM dial, as well as to the rest of the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca. We are very excited today because we are interviewing Dave Lindorf. And, of course, Dave is a well-known journalist, activist, and columnist for Counterpunch, and also founding member of ThisCan'tBeHappening.net, which is the new independent, collectively owned, journalist-run, reader-backed online alternative newspaper. That's ThisCan'tBeHappening.net. And it's where the story, the Raymond Davis coverage in particular, is being broken. So let's see if we have Dave on the line. Dave, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Excellent. Again, I'm just so excited that you can be here today. I'm a big fan. I read your columns all the time. And we had you on the program a couple of years back, and I've been following your comments on Obama and the civility in U.S. political discourse, or how there's perhaps too much civility. You have a real feel for the emotions in U.S. politics, and you bring a certain energy. In this case, you have broken the story at Counterpunch, at This Can't Be Happening, ahead of the corporate media, and that is on the Raymond Davis arrest in Pakistan. And this is the arrest of someone who appears to be operating on behalf of the United States. We're not sure exactly which branch, but I guess as far back as February 8th, you've been reporting on this story. What caught your eye about it that suggested there might be more to this story?
Well, before I tell you, let me say that the Times and the Post, apparently the New York Times and the Washington Post, had the story before me, but sat on it. And what we now know is that they had confirmation from government sources that Davis was a CIA contract agent within days of his shooting these two Pakistanis in Lahore to death. But they sat on it because the White House asked them to, and they actually sat on it knowing he was a CIA agent, even on February 15th when President Obama said at a press conference that he's, quote, our diplomat, and lectured Pakistan on the rules of international law that require a diplomat to have international, diplomatic immunity. So, in other words, the Times and the Post actually published knowingly the president's lies to the American public, which is quite astonishing.
Absolutely. That's been a major feature of several of your articles in Counterpunch. Although you weren't the first person to report on the story directly, you did your own independent research and released information on your own behalf that the media was intentionally sitting on. And there's a few reasons why that is. There's a few aspects to that. I guess we should start with the original incident and look at what happened, why this is such a big deal. And obviously it caught your notice that what happened there, it was really out of the ordinary that you had Raymond Davis appearing to shoot two men, two Pakistani men, eight times in total through his glass windshield. And those men were on motorcycles, isn't that right?
Yeah. Well, here's the deal. The storyline that most Americans still believe, because it's how the U.S. has reported it, is that he thought he was being threatened and was going to be robbed by these two guys on motorcycles, and so he shot and killed them. But the reality is that, and this is what's not been in the mainstream media, is, first of all, it appears that they didn't even pull guns, that they were shot from in front of the car through his windshield, eight shots fired through a windshield with a pistol in which he hit them every time. I mean, this is quite a marksman, and he then got out of the car. One guy was trying to run away, hadn't been, mortally injured yet, and he shot him in the back and killed him, and then he walked over to the other guy who was prone on the ground and dying and fired an execution shot into his head. So this was not a man who was feeling threatened at all. In fact, he was the aggressor. And
it looks so, like he wanted to make sure they were dead.
He wanted to make sure they were very, very dead, and then he tried to escape in his car and was captured. Now, this is where it gets interesting. When he was captured, he started saying, "I'm a consular official. They brought him to the police station. We have on our website a videotape that was taken by a cell phone camera that was left on the floor when he was brought into the police station, in which you actually see him and hear him saying, "I'm a contract worker at the Lahore consulate." Now, that's really important because consular employees do not have diplomatic immunity. And so, at any rate, the interesting thing here is that what's been reported in the Pakistani press and not reported in the U.S. is that police found in his car an extraordinary list of and on his person in his pockets an extraordinary array of stuff that is not something that a diplomat carries. He had a Glock and a Beretta semi-automatic pistol, and he had multiple filled high-capacity magazines, clips for these two guns. He had killer bullets that are not even legal in Pakistan. You know, these are the high-impact, hollow-point kind of bullets that are designed to do maximal damage when they hit a person.
So he wasn't out for a pleasure cruise.
No, he was carrying, like, bucket loads of bullets. I saw photographs in the Dawn newspaper, published photographs of the bullets they recovered from him. There were literally bucket loads of multi-variety calibers of bullets for the Beretta, the Glock, and M16. He had a night vision headlamp that was forehead mounted. He had a telescope. He had wire clippers. He had a pile of batteries. He had multiple cell phones, a cell phone tracking device, a fancy GPS device with removable memory cards of a type apparently that's used in the assigning of target data for those drones that the U.S. is sending over Pakistan to bomb in the tribal areas. He had masks and makeup.
This is really a spy story stuff.
It is. It is. It's like all spy stuff. And the other thing he had was a camera, which he used to photograph the two guys he'd executed before getting in his car, which is a tactic of that hitmen use, when they're taking somebody out to show that they've done the job. But also on that camera, police found photographs of Pakistani military installations, both in Lahore and on the Indian-Pakistan border, and they also found pictures of mosques and schools, madrasas, and even a Montessori school. What I find chilling in these pictures is that these are the very things that are being blown up in this wave that's been going on for 2 years now in Pakistan of terror bombings. And it's led the Pakistani press to claim that this guy was not a spy. He was organizing terror attacks. And as support of that, the latest news is that the police found on his cell phones 33 calls. 27 of them were to known figures in the Pakistani Taliban and an organization that was a shadowy terrorist organization that is known to have been or suspected to have been behind the assassination of Benazir Bhutto and also the kidnapping and beheading of Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl. So, I mean, these are really obnoxious, horrible people that he's talking to on the phone. Well, repeatedly.
Wow, and this is something that's coming out in India and Pakistan. It's being discussed, and it certainly appears to be underreported here. I guess in order to...
I would say blacked out would be a better word.
Blacked out, along with other aspects of the story, who he is and things like that. There had been some changes in terms of his story and the official story, the U.S. government story. I know you've been looking at that. I guess to understand that, we need to think about his immediate reaction. As you say, he was caught, he was captured. How did Davis initially explain the incident, the shooting that took place?
He initially claimed that he thought the guys were robbers who were threatening to rob him. And so he took out one of his heavy-duty pistols and blew them away. But, of course, that was belied by the evidence that they were shot in the back and through the front windshield of his car, and that, he then got out and made sure they were dead when they were no longer a threat. And then it's come out that they weren't really robbers. They are, by all accounts, they were working for the ISI, Inter Services Intelligence, which is Pakistan's intelligence agency. And the reports in Pakistan are that they were tailing him because there was suspicions that he had crossed the line from being simply a director of intelligence to something much more nefarious and dangerous. And so they were following him and keeping tabs on him. So his story fell apart real fast about the robbery thing, although the U.S. is still pushing that line in talking with U.S. reporters. The other thing is he had a identity card on him, which I ran a photo of on our site. It's a photo ID that lists him as a DOD, Department of Defense contractor. That's interesting because they're now saying that he's a CIA contractor, but that is belied, I think, by the DOD thing. There are a lot, apparently as many as several hundred undercover people from the U.S. who are working apparently in Pakistan for the Joint Special Force, Special Operations Force of the Pentagon, working on supposedly anti-terrorist stuff without the knowledge of the ISI or the Department of Interior in Pakistan or the Foreign Office. And it's it seems probable to me that this is what Davis really is, because he's had 10 years. It's reported in the Times that he had 10 years in special forces for the U.S. He supposedly was there until 2003 with them, and has also worked for Blackwater.
Well, this is one of the key difficulties in trying to understand what was happening, and that is who he is or who he works for, because it's been hard to establish that so far. It's one of the areas where you've distinguished yourself in doing primary research on that. For those that are just tuning in, of course, we're speaking with Dave Lindorf, a journalist, activist, columnist for Counterpunch. Again, I should mention he's a founding member of ThisCan'tBeHappening.net. That's ThisCan'tBeHappening.net. And this is a collectively owned, journalist-run alternative newspaper. He's been breaking the stories because what you've been doing, Dave, is you were not satisfied with the explanations that were given initially at the outset of this incident. You wanted to learn more about Davis and what might be going on. You did some footwork. You did some telephoning and some exploring, and you were looking into his identity because, as you said, he had a number of business cards at his capsule.
Let me tell you that story. That's a fascinating story, and I'm actually really proud of how it worked out. It was kind of lucky. When I read the story about him, something didn't ring right because it said he was claiming to be a consular worker, but he also had a business card or business cards in his jacket or shirt that police found, which identified him as an employee of something called Hyperion Protective Consultants, and listed an address in Florida, in Orlando, at this 5100 North Lane. And so what I did was I looked up the company on, you know, just did a Google search, and I found a website by that name, which when you went to it, it was a little funky. It had some misspellings and, you know, stuff. It didn't quite look right. But it listed its address as the same address on the card, the 5100 address. So I went to Google Earth, and probably most of your listeners know about Google Earth, where you can actually look at your house, you know,
yes,
from satellite pictures. And I honed in on that address, and as you know, Google, particularly in the U.S., probably Canada too, has done a lot of drive-arounds where they do side shots from cars and cameras of the same properties. So you can, once you get close to it, you can go to a side shot and actually see a photograph of the address. So I went down, found the building. It was a shopping mall, and it turned out to be one of the streets that they had done the side shots on, so I went and looked at it, and I was struck by the fact that it was a shopping mall in which all the stores were vacant. There were no signs on any of the placard spaces where signs would be, and it wasn't a car in the parking lot. So that seemed curious to me, so I backed up a little bit on the Google Earth and looked at properties adjacent to it. There was an office building across the street from this shopping strip mall. It was really a strip mall, and it listed it as a company that provides halfway houses for rehabilitating drug addicts. And so I looked up their website, called their number, got a guy who I'm not, you know, he might have been Canadian. He's either from Minnesota or Canada. I'm not good at picking those accents apart, but it's one or the other, you know. And really sweet guy, and he offered, I explained what I was doing, and he offered to walk across the street and check out the address. So he goes across the street and he comes back to the phone about 15 minutes later, and he said that 5100 was an empty store property. It had shelves on one wall that were empty and a counter on the other wall that was empty, except for a Coke glass on the counter that was also empty. And he said there was a rental sign, rental agency sign in the window, and he had written down the number. So very resourceful guy. And he said that as far as he could remember, having worked there for at least a year, that the strip mall had been vacant. And so I called the rental agency number, and I asked them about this company. And they said that the property had been empty for 2 years and that they had never rented to a company by that name.
But there was something there that might have been related to that. Your investigation, it showed that the building had rented space to, I think it was a one-man clothing store until...
Yeah. They had rented, prior to 2009, they had rented to a guy whose name was listed as the manager of Hyperion Protective Consultants, who was running a clothing store there, and he had mentioned to them that he might be getting mail for this Hyperion Consulting Protective Consultants. So there is a connection, but there certainly was no company there. And additionally, when I called the Secretary of State's office, which every company in Florida has to register with the Secretary of State, and this company, they told me, had been decertified as a company 2 years prior for non-filing of any documentation. So it looks like a front company, and that, you know, rang alarm bells to me. So there was another reference to a Hyperion Protective Services in a New York Times article, which listed a Utah address, and I looked them up, and there was some promotional information about them in Las Vegas, some business advertising sheet online, but it gave the same website in Orlando as the main company office. So the whole thing is a sham. By the way, the phone number for that address was a Tucson, Arizona cell phone. So, you know, it all was extremely funky, and I think was simply a cover for this guy. But that's what rang all the alarm bells for me,
yeah,
and
this
got
is
me into the case.
We were able to follow this as you were writing it throughout February, and this is where you were doing the phoning and using Google Earth and so on, while the media had information about him allegedly being a CIA security contractor. They were sitting on information.
Sitting on it, yeah.
I was such a maze trying to figure out what this company was about. It was all very fishy. You couldn't get much from the phones. You learned that it didn't seem to be very present physically anywhere.
But it had it didn't have any listed number. I called the phone company covers Orlando. The website listed three phone numbers. They had an 800 number that, when you called it, had a recording with information about what to do if you get a foreclosure notice. And nothing to do with, you know, security or consulting.
Well, it's a good thing you're able to find that gentleman who worked across the street. He was very polite and helpful. Maybe he was Canadian after all.
Well, Minnesotans are polite too.
That's true.
The other two phones, one was a cell phone that had been disconnected, and the other was a phone number that had a recording that didn't say anything about Hyperion, and it just asked you to leave your name and number, which I did, and asked whoever was supposedly staffing that to call me back, which they didn't.
Well, the background details about Davis is something that the media was given some information on, and they were sitting on it. And when you look into it, you can see why. Because when he was arrested, as you say, there was a claim of diplomatic immunity. He said he was a contract employee for the embassy, so they don't have...
No, for the consulate.
Consulate, sorry. Yes, a contract. So he worked for the consulate, but he's not someone who would have full diplomatic immunity. But the charges that he's being held for are so severe that the United States government has intervened now. I know that the reaction in Pakistan at the outset and until this day has been pretty immense. I understand people, they want to see a trial.
Well, yeah, and the crime got worse because besides the two guys he killed, he called for help, apparently, and a SUV that had three or four guys in it who were apparently contractors like him, it sped to the scene. It drove across a median into an oncoming lane in order to try to get to him and ran over a poor schmuck riding a motorcycle who had nothing to do with any of this and killed him. And then in a panic, these guys turned around and hightailed it back to the consulate where they sought sanctuary. And when the police said they wanted to talk to them, the consulate refused to divulge their names or anything and later spirited them all out of the country. So this has infuriated Pakistanis. And then adding to that, the 18-year-old bride of one of the two men he shot and killed, who had only married this guy 6 months before, committed suicide by ingesting a large amount of rat poison. And when she was dying in the hospital, they were unable to save her. And when she was dying, she gave an interview to a television station in Pakistan and said that she had done it because she despaired of her husband getting justice and she wanted a trial and a hanging for the man who killed her husband. Well, you know, in Pakistan, that's pretty heavy duty. So
yes, it suggests that there's more to the story, and it's also very tragic. This is one of the ways you can look at this is collateral damage. And certainly the United States has been engaged in all sorts of operations across Pakistan with the drones and the various agents they have. And I know that the U.S. government wants to maintain the status quo. Obama, he called Davis, at first, is this right? He called Davis our diplomat in Pakistan.
Yep, that's right.
So there's efforts to portray him as a diplomat and an embassy employee. Senator Lindsey Graham, I think, slipped up there. You said that he referred to Davis as our agent.
Yeah, on the floor he referred to him as they've got our agent. We have to get him back.
Right.
You know?
So, but it's not
a little more accurate.
Well,
although he's a contractor. You know, my personal feeling, and this is totally a gut feeling, is that the level of anxiety being expressed by the U.S. to have a president get up in public and lie, in a situation where he's bound to be caught in the lie, and to send, you know, they dispatched Senator Kerry, the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, they dispatched Gates, the Secretary of Defense, they dispatched Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, all to lean on Pakistan. They threatened, although this was there's no way they would follow through with this, and they're backing down now, but they threatened to withhold Pakistani foreign aid and military aid. They canceled a visit scheduled by Zardari to the U.S., and this is a crucial ally, remember, for the U.S. in its war in Afghanistan. They're doing all this over this guy who, clearly shot and killed these guys and really clearly isn't entitled to diplomatic immunity. They tried to submit false documentation to claim that he, in a really shabby effort to try to pretend that he worked for the embassy in Islamabad. All of this for a guy who clearly, did something terrible. And so you got to ask why. And I think the reason why is they're afraid that if there is a trial and if they, the Pakistanis put the thumbscrews on him or the waterboard him or whatever, that he's going to squeal about what he really is, and that's both, I think, an organizer of terror bombings and also not a CIA operative, but a active duty special forces person working undercover, which is totally, that's a war crime. And people should realize that the Geneva Conventions say that for soldiers to operate without uniform in countries is a war crime.
Well, in terms of Geneva Conventions, I understand the U.S. has been using that selectively in the diplomatic
conventions.
Oh, absolutely.
We use it whenever we feel like we want to, and we ignore it the rest of the time.
On the treatment of foreign nationals and embassy staff, it's been
right.
One way. But, yeah, they were trying to protect him with a diplomatic card, and this was when the media, they were still sitting on his identity.
Right.
Right. So they were sort of keeping quiet and going along with the story that the government was pushing at the time.
But the other thing is, they on this question of where he works, on January 25th, the U.S. every year has to submit to Pakistan a list of people that are diplomats working out of the embassy, because those people do get diplomatic immunity, and they have to send a list for approval by the Foreign Office. The decision on who gets immunity is made by the host country, not by the embassy. The U.S. can't say he's a diplomat because we give him a diplomatic passport. It has to be decided by the host country. That's true in the U.S., it's true in Canada, it's true in Pakistan. So they sent a list containing the names of the people that the embassy felt should have this status as diplomat, and it had 48 names on it. It was sent to the Foreign Office, as they did at the start of every year, on January 25th, 2 days before the shooting. And Davis's name was not on that list. And then a day after the shooting, they submitted what they called a revised list and said they had inadvertently left Davis's name off.
Oh, they forgot. Nobody
believed that. Zardari tried to pressure the foreign minister to accept it and backdate the information and declare him a diplomat, because Zardari, the president of Pakistan, wanted to get this over and done with and sent out, and have him sent out of the country as fast as possible before the heat built up. But to his misfortune, the Minister of Foreign Affairs was a honorable man and refused to do it and said that all the facts spoke against that, and he refused. So he was sacked, and Zardari is left embarrassed with having tried to do it. And then the other thing the U.S. did was when he was arrested, he had a regular U.S. passport and a regular visa. But then the U.S. came from the consulate. Somebody came running over the next day and said, oh, we have a diplomatic passport for him. We'd like to exchange it.
Right. Right. Okay. Well, it's really extraordinary, the implications of this, the photographs you've mentioned of the madrasas, the religious schools of the type that are being targeted for explosions. It's very disturbing. And I know it must have disturbed people in Pakistan. It seems 9 out of 10 people want a trial, want information about what happens. And I guess we got to wrap up, but there are some implications in the medium term right now. I guess the United States has had to curtail the diplomatic activities of some of its various agents and staff in Pakistan.
Yeah, you're saying diplomat in quotes, I think.
Well, what they call diplomats.
No, what's happened is that in the latest in the Pakistani press that I've been following is that they're saying that 30 American contractors have had to stop their activities because of this. One's been arrested in Peshawar and is being investigated now, who claims to work for another contracting firm, which sounded really fascinating. And the another 12 have fled the country. This guy that was just arrested, Aaron DeHaven, works for this company called Catalyst Services, and I looked their website up, and it describes itself as, get this, they say they have experience in logistics, operations, security, and finance, and they say that their staff is led by, and this is a quote from their website, individuals who have been involved in some of the most significant events in the last 20 years, including the breakup of the Soviet Union, the U.S. effort in Somalia, and the global war on terror.
It's quite a resume.
They're actually saying that they have people who helped with the breakup of the Soviet Union. Do you really want these people in your country?
It's quite a continuity of operations, too, of State Department or whatever institutions are involved in this. You know,
Our diplomats,
our boys, and we got messages in 2006, 2005 about U.S. agents and other people operating on the ground in Pakistan. I guess now we know what that means in terms of real operations.
Yeah, you know, this harks back, by the way, to British operatives who were found in Basra, captured by Basra police, Iraqi police, back in, I think, 2004. They were wearing Arab clothes in a civilian car, and when they were stopped and the police looked in the car, they found bomb-making materials in the car. So they arrested the guys, who were Brits, and then British special forces broke through the wall of the police station and rescued these guys and got them away. Clearly, they were on bombing missions, Brits on bombing missions, which tells you again, you know, what the Americans and the Brits are doing in these countries.
I remember that story. It was big, and we stopped hearing about it at a certain point. But we need to be thinking about these things and what they mean, and what they mean in the context of the war on terror. And I'm so glad you brought attention to this. Again, your articles, we wanted to cover them even earlier. There's been so much in the Middle East, but this is an ongoing issue. And if people want to look into it and get the latest articles, I know you're posting them. You're sending them to thiscan'tbehappening.net. So that's the place to get the updates, right?
Yeah, there's an archive under my name. It's a box that says Dave Lindorf's Posts, and if people click on that the articles there. They can find probably 6 or 7 articles on this that'll cover everything.
Oh, that's great. And I highly recommend going there as well as just staying tuned on Counterpunch, where many of Dave's articles show up. Dave, we're so grateful you could be with us. This is extraordinary material, and you did a top job making sure that ordinary people were getting that information, even if others were sitting on it. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you for airing the story and having me on.
That's great, Dave. And we'll put a link to your articles and your website on our program. So
thank you very much.
Bye-bye, Dave.
Bye-bye.
That was Dave Lindorf. We are speaking with the well-known journalist, activist, columnist for Counterpunch, and founding member of ThisCan'tBeHappening.net.